Eye on the Arctic, Views from the North, I'm Elise Quinn. Now, 2013 was an important year for Arctic news, and especially here in Canada. Now, at the beginning of the year, Canada took over chairmanship of the Arctic Council from Sweden. And this gave issues around Arctic development and the future of northern communities increased prominence in mainstream media and even general political discussions. Now, the list could go on and on, so today we've asked an Arctic expert to join us to help us make sense of some of this year's developments. Heather Exnier-Piro is the managing editor for the Arctic Yearbook, and she's also one of our bloggers here at Eye on the Arctic. And she joins me on the line today from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Hello, Heather Exnier-Piro. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, when you look back at the big Arctic stories and issues of 2013, what stands out for you most?
I've literally have a list here of about a dozen things that could probably be mentioned. But for myself as a political scientist, it's been accumulating the political interest, the international interest in the Arctic. But it really culminated this year at the Arctic Council Ministerial when finally there was a decision made and six new states, China, India, Japan, Korea, Singapore, and even Italy, were accepted as observers to the Arctic Council. And it's, you know, there have been states accepted. They weren't the first new observers, but it just really marked this growing global interest and Asian interest in the Arctic and in the Arctic Council. So that was a really big news item for 2013. But the other thing that happened at the Arctic Council Ministerial, and I don't think it got enough publicity or attention, was that an Inuk, or an Arctic resident, for the first time was named to the chair. And, of course, that's Canada's own Leona Glukak from Joe Bay in Nunavut. So it's a testimony that, you know, back in 1996, when the Arctic Council was set up, Indigenous peoples were invited at the table to sit at the table. And finally, 16, 17 years later, an Arctic Indigenous person is at the head of the table.
Do you see Arctic policy being reshaped in any discernible way at this point in Canada's chairmanship?
I have not. And I think Canada was ambitious and did try to steer the Arctic Council in a different way. So for the last 16 years, for the first cycle of chairmanships, there's been a really strong focus on environmental protection. But the Arctic Council actually has a twin mandate, and in addition to that, it's supposed to do sustainable development. And it has never been really successful or really ambitious on that side. So Canada has tried to reshift the focus of the Arctic Council from kind of an environmental focus to one that focuses on human development and development for Arctic peoples, I think was the technical name of the theme. But I can't say that I haven't seen that Canada maybe has been effective in pulling along everyone else to that kind of human and that development side. There's actually been some criticism that, you know, it's kind of a conservative platform to do economic development, resource exploitation. But I think the message is very important that there are people that, you know, it's a homeland, people live there, they need jobs, they want self-sufficiency. And certainly we see it in Greenland and in northern Alaska that people that live in the Arctic are looking for this kind of development. But has that transferred to, you know, kind of the southern capitals and to the John Kerrys, in the United States who still kind of reflectively think of climate change or polar bears when they think of the Arctic? I have not seen evidence of that yet.
We also saw a new Arctic group being formed, and it was the president of Iceland that was behind it. Now, remind us a little bit about what that was about. They had their first meeting this year, and sort of what you sort of noticed as you were watching it.
Sure, and I did have the opportunity to attend the Arctic Circle. And it was interesting that the Arctic Circle was announced by President Grimson before the ministerial. So there was still a time of uncertainty. Would China, India, Japan, et cetera, be accepted to the Arctic Council? And I think the idea even for the Arctic Circle, that new group that you mentioned, came about, you know, probably 2 or 3 years ago. And it was a response to this perceived exclusivity of the Arctic Council and even of the Arctic Five, the five littoral states. So this was a real effort from especially Alaskans, some Greenlanders and Icelanders were especially prominent in organizing this to really make the Arctic, provide a global forum for people to talk about the Arctic, learn about the Arctic, and become involved. And so it's certainly interesting. It's certainly achieved, I think, what it wanted to achieve. There's a lot of CEOs, Costco Group was there, Google was there, kind of many of the usual suspects that you'd expect in academia or in politics. So in that respect, it was a great networking event. But it had very much a global focus. And I don't know that in Arctic politics or in the Arctic community, we've done enough to really marry the regional and the local and the global into a kind of cohesive kind of policy direction.
And so now we talked about some of the sort of the highlights. I wanted to know from your vantage point, when you look back over Arctic developments in 2013, do you feel that there were issues or stories that were overlooked, but that would be worth examining, re-examining if we could?
Yeah, there's a ton. I could go on. But two that will stand out for me is, you know, there's still, and especially the New York Times has been terrible this year with just op-eds, always with the rush to the Arctic kind of a theme. They've had several this year. But two stories do stand out, which really demonstrated the cooperation that we're actually seeing on the ground in the Arctic. One is Canada had its annual Operation Nanook, which since 2007 has kind of visits Arctic sovereignty, kind of demonstrating its capacity, military and defense-wise in the Arctic. And it had started to invite observers in the last few years, Denmark and the United States, of course, its closest neighbors. But this year, it also invited a handful of other countries, including Sweden, the UK, and Russia. And this is something very unique because the whole point of the exercise back in 2007 was as a symbol of you know, what we could do versus a potential Russian adversary. And it was not even mentioned by the, Canada Defense. It was not mentioned by anybody. But this was a big deal. In a similar vein, this week, Canada and also Denmark last week submitted parts of their continental shelf claims to the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea Continental Shelf Commission. And this has been the story that, you know, for the last 10 years, when you say who owns the Arctic or what claims are being made in the Arctic, we're really talking about the continental shelf under this law of the sea construct. So it was a big deal this week that Canada and Denmark finally submitted their claims. But what got less talked about when we're talking about flags and territory and sovereignty is that Canada, the United States, Denmark, Russia all worked pretty hand in hand together. They shared scientific information. They shared, you know, they went on boats together, shared boats, shared missions, really to come up with the best quality scientific evidence that people can make a legal and a political decision on. So what may look from on the surface like another sovereignty kind of a ploy, beneath the surface there was tons of multilateral cooperation.
And again, those stories that have to do with cooperation, they don't get resonate as much as the ones, as you mentioned, race to the Arctic and whatnot.
No, they don't. And I don't know why, because if you think what is special about the Arctic or what is interesting politically or from an IR perspective on the Arctic is that it does do cooperation really well, that it does resolve disputes really well. There hasn't been a war, even though a lot is at stake. So for me, looking at what is interesting about the Arctic, it is the cooperation side. But, you know, people that Russian flag, titanium flag at the North Pole, that's just what gets dragged out just about every single week. So it's interesting, you know, some kind of psychology of what, you know, media and people are interested in. They're interested in that conflict story. But I think the far more interesting story is how well, in 6 years, the Arctic community has been able to deal with many of these issues.
I'm wondering, do you see media coverage of the Arctic changing? Or do you think there's still areas that for some reason aren't getting the attention that they should be?
Well, what are the ones missing? Certainly mental health is a big one. A lot of kind of the local development issues, K-12 graduation, those things don't get a lot of play in maybe the international, even the national media that we're used to. But there's very high quality local ones. You yourselves are one, but Nunatsiak News, Alaska Dispatch, Barents Observer, that really talk about kind of local issues. And I even think of the recent Nunavut election. You know, one of the biggest issues of that election was social promotion in schools. And, you know, should kids just kind of pass through the K-12 system, even if they haven't necessarily earned the marks so that they can keep up with their peers and they can earn a high school degree? And that's a very important local issue. It would not resonate really with a southern crowd or an international crowd. It has nothing to do with polar bears. affairs. But it got a lot of attention within that local kind of community, that local media. So I say there are pockets and everyone's serving their audience. So I think even if you're not in Nunavut or if you're not in Tromso, you can still find that news and still, you know, find out really what's happening with some of these pockets of a really great local media representatives.
And I wanted to visit your blog post for us from the last year. One in particular was one on Inuit diplomacy. I wanted to know what role this has played in some of the developments this last year, or even how you think it's going to play a role sort of in the months and years ahead on some of these big issues that we've touched on.
Yeah, that's a great question. And what was interesting in Canadian perspective was this I Don't Know More movement. And especially, you know, I've also followed Southern and Saskatchewan First Nations politics very closely. And it was very, very close, you know, to people's hearts and feelings, kind of really on the surface of feelings down here. But it's just not the same in the Arctic and the High North. And part of that is just that the Inuit have a very different relationship with the federal government, with central governments, and with diplomacy. And they've just been tremendously effective. And you know, you can list off some of the great Inuit diplomats, Mary Simon, Patricia Cochran, Shilawat Cloutier, that have just, you know, done fundamentally important things for their community and for this country and for the Arctic, and just a list of achievements and shifts in the culture of thinking about it, and which is just different from the mentality or the approach or the culture that you have with Southern First Nations or you know, even just Cree and Dene even. So it's very interesting to see how the Inuit's political culture is, what they have achieved with that, and how successful they've been with that. And you're seeing it with Greenland as well, that they're just a very pragmatic, they have a very pragmatic political culture. So, you know, without the ICC, without Inuit, and I'm sure other people will disagree or temper what may sound like praise, but really leading that and able to convince and persuade, you know, kind of more traditional decision makers, you know, white politicians and whatnot, of their importance and of their voice and at the seat. And maybe the most telling of this is how far Canada sided with Inuit on the seal ban.
Mm-hmm. A big story this year.
That's a huge story. And it's just so telling of Canada's position, how much Inuit and have really, and Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs have aligned, how perfectly almost they've aligned. And we see that even with our chairmanship agenda versus maybe traditional environmentalists or Europeans who really look at the Arctic through a preservation lens. And here Canada and the UN are hand in hand going against the EU at a time when Canada is negotiating a free trade agreement with the EU to say, you know, this is really important. This is their culture. This is their livelihood. And Canada is going to support that. And we're seeing that this week again with Canada kind of versus the world with the polar bear, the renegotiation of the polar bear treaty. So two very important issues for Inuit, polar bears, seal hunt, and Canada has not diminished at all, you know, in the face of EU pressure or European pressure or American pressure.
Well, Heather Exner-Pirro, thank you so much for joining us today. And we will have to revisit our conversation again next year.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.